Hello and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSwinney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio. Stripping terrorists of their citizenship and banning the niqab at citizenship oaths. These two topics have become major controversial wedge issues on the campaign trail, with the Conservatives pushing hard for both despite criticisms and court challenges. We have a constitutional law professor on the show to help us break these issues down. The numbers are in. In this federal election, Canadians will be choosing from more than 1,400 candidates to fill 338 seats in the House of Commons. But only a third of those candidates are women. To talk more about this issue, we're joined by the head of Equal Voice Canada. Are Aboriginal issues being overlooked in this campaign? From high school dropout rates to sexual assault and suicide, there are many serious problems facing Indigenous communities that have not been thrust into the spotlight yet. We speak with First Nation lawyer Catherine Hensel. And later, we're joined by musician Dan Mangan about an anti-conservative concert series, while the McLean's panel weighs in on the NDP slide in the polls. For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill. Two issues have popped up on the campaign trail that have divided both politicians and Canadians. The first issue, which has arguably created the most passionate debate, is the ban on face coverings, like the niqab, at citizenship ceremonies. Despite court rulings and criticism from the other parties, the Conservatives are standing by the ban. The issue is not even a widespread problem, with Citizenship and Immigration confirming this week only two women have not received their citizenship because they chose to wear the niqab. Nonetheless, we have seen many Canadians supporting the move, and polls are shifting as a result of this debate, especially in Quebec, where the NDP has been losing support to the Conservatives over this issue. The other topic, which has recently been grabbing more headlines, is the government attempts to strip the citizenships of dual nationals who are convicted of terrorism offenses. McLean's magazine was the first to report that the government is attempting to strip the citizenship from a criminal who was born and raised in our country. 27-year-old Saad Gaya was one of the Toronto 18, which plotted to set off bombs in Canada's largest city and attack Parliament. He pled guilty, and the government is now trying to deport him to Pakistan, since that's where his parents are from. But the thing is, Gaya was born in Montreal and raised in Oakville. He has never lived in Pakistan, nor has he ever applied for Pakistani citizenship. When asked about the case, Conservative candidate Pierre Poilievre defended his party's stance.
Those who are convicted in a court of law, beyond a reasonable doubt, of an offense defined as terrorism in our criminal code, and who have dual nationality, will lose their citizenship. I believe it is entirely fair and completely reasonable. And when these sentences are done, we don't want these terrorists in our country.
Now, both the citizenship and the niqab issues are being challenged before the courts. To discuss the matters more in depth, I'm joined on the phone now by Carissa Mamathan, a law professor at the University of Ottawa, who has an expertise in constitutional law. First off, on a basic level, what's your take on the citizenship issue as it stands right now?
I think that as it stands right now, in terms of the focus on dual nationals, the law does create a distinction. It treats differently dual nationals from other Canadian citizens, and that, I think, is very likely to be seen as a discriminatory difference based on your national or ethnic origin. So there's, you know, potential, I think, for an equality rights argument against the application of the law to some citizens, but not others.
So it's unequal justice in a way?
Well, it's exposing people to very different kinds of consequences for what are admittedly serious offenses based on something over which in some cases they may have no control. And we see that in the recent case of Mr. Gaya, against whom the government is arguing he is now a citizen of Pakistan based on the accident of his birth, when he was born in Canada to parents who had renounced their Pakistani citizenship, but now the government argues because of decisions taken by the government of Pakistan, he can now be considered a dual national.
But what about those who do have control? What about those who may have been born somewhere else, chose to have citizenships in two countries, and commit terrorism offenses here in Canada?
So that's a good question, because you're right that in some cases, citizenship can reflect a choice. The the charter makes citizenship itself something on which you're not supposed to discriminate. And the basic idea is you shouldn't be forcing people to make a choice, let's say at the outset, between something like dual citizenship or remaining a Canadian citizen, a sole Canadian citizen, on the idea that at some point they may be subject to a much harsher penalty. So in terms of what we call, you know, equality principles, there's the idea, is it actually fair to put people to that choice? But then going a little bit further, is that in fact a sensible distinction on which to decide whether someone gets stripped of their citizenship or not?
But the point being made by the Conservatives in defending their law when they introduced and passed in government is that the problem here is that these people are committing offenses against the state, whether it be treason or terrorism. They are wishing violence upon their fellow citizens, and then therefore they're not worthy of having Canadian citizenship because they're basically acting out against the state itself.
It's important to note that prior to this law, the only basis on which Canadian citizenship could be revoked is fraud in obtaining that citizenship, where the person lies about some aspect of their past, like war crimes, that would otherwise have led the government to refuse to grant them citizenship. This is about whether post-citizenship behavior or conduct or crimes can be a basis on which to then take that status away from you. And I think that it's clear that, you know, the government believes that that's valid. We've never done it before, and I think it really, there's a very important conversation to be had about what is it that makes our citizenship valid? Like, what are the bases on which we can take away citizenship? And it just opens up the door to a lot of arbitrary decisions because they're tying it to the commission of an offense. So it's clearly a form of punishment, but it's not before the courts. I mean, it's the decision is going to be made, it appears, on a purely political basis. And I think that's something about which we can be legitimately concerned.
Do you think that there's enough basis here to bring this to the Supreme Court? The government has already shown that it doesn't feel like it wants to back down on any of these issues.
Do I think this will ultimately arrive at the Supreme Court's door? Yes, I think it will, no matter how the lower courts decide, because first of all, it's an unprecedented issue. It raises important issues of constitutional and charter rights. And it you know, really goes to fundamental aspects about our society, our democracy, our community. And while there is, of course, there's room for decisions to be made about that at a political level, when we also have constitutional rights in play, then you know, the courts have, I think, an important role in at least providing a check on the decisions that the government makes.
Now, the other issue that has really popped up as a wedge issue in this campaign trail is the issue over banning the niqab at citizenship ceremonies. There's also a court challenge over that. Apparently, according to polls, has more than the support of more than 80% of Canadians in a taxpayer-funded poll that was done for the government. If Canadians want this ban and the government decides to make it, what is the legal issue here? Why is this being challenged?
Well, it's a pretty basic principle of our societies that, you know, we protect certain rights against the desires of even very strong majorities, because we respect minority rights and we respect minority groups in our society. And it's frankly risky to leave these decisions to popular decision making that can be stoked up, that can be really are being used perhaps for purely political ends, in this case in the context of an election. It's not to say that you know, a strong enough popular sentiment won't be, you know, will have no relevance, but we generally, when it comes to issues of rights, we have recognized over many decades that we generally don't want to leave those entirely in the hands of just what's most popular to the greatest number of people.
But would it not be up to the elected government to make the choice as to the requirements for people coming into our country?
They can, absolutely, they can do so, but they themselves are bound by our Constitution, right? We have the rule of law, which means that everyone in this country, every institution, every actor is bound by the higher law provided by our Constitution, and there is not unlimited discretion to decide what the law is. I will point out that in this case, what the courts have held is that the current law did not allow the minister to issue a directive that people would have to be forced to remove a face covering. The current law, which was set by a Democratic majority in Parliament, provides for a ceremony in which you can take your oath, but do so in ways that are consistent with your beliefs, as long as security and identity concerns are being met.
Now, the Conservatives argue that this is about Canadian values, and if you want to come to this country and become a Canadian citizen, you have to accept the values that it is to be a Canadian and show your face and take the oath and not be ashamed of taking the oath publicly. How do you respond to that?
I think this is one of the most interesting aspects of this argument, because it really shows the almost diametrically opposed ways you can view the ceremony. So the government's argument is, this is the moment when you should be willing to accept, in this case, a social custom or more, that we show our face. But the opposite side is that we also have freedom of conscience, freedom of expression, freedom of religion. I mean, those are also deeply held values. And so why wouldn't the citizenship ceremony be the moment where we most allow those rights to be expressed, as long as the security and identity concerns have already been met?
That was Carissima Mathen, a law professor at the University of Ottawa, discussing the issues of stripping citizenship from terrorists and the ban of the niqab at citizenship ceremonies. Still to come on the show, we speak with Equal Voice about the number of women candidates in this election. We talk about the overlooked issues facing Aboriginal people. We speak with musician Dan Mangan about a concert series protesting the Conservatives. And the Maclean's panel weighs in on the New Democrat slide in the polls. Welcome back to Maclean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio. Coming up on the show, we talk about why Aboriginal issues are being overlooked in this campaign. Musician Dan Mangan is here to discuss an anti-conservative concert series. And the Maclean's panel discusses the NDP slide in the polls and a change in campaigning by the Tories. But first, nominations for the federal election close this week, so we now have the final tallies of who's running. Among the five major parties, Conservative, Liberal, NDP, Green, and Bloc Québécois, 1,428 candidates will be on the ballots for October 19th. For a closer look, though, at how many women are running and a sense of their chances of winning, Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes spoke with Nancy Peckford, Chief Spokesperson for Equal Voice, a group that encourages women to run for office. John started off by asking Peckford for a quick national snapshot of women vying for votes in this hard-fought campaign.
So we have done an analysis of the major five parties. So that would include the Conservatives, the Liberals, the New Democrats, the Greens, and the Bloc Québécois in Quebec. And what we have now discovered, with nominations closed on September 28th, is that we have 473 women running for those major parties, and that equals 33%.
Exactly a third. Does that sound good to you or bad? What do you think of that?
That is an excellent question, John. So what we've found, and certainly we are encouraged to see, that there's a 2-point increase from the last federal election in 2011. So we're up by 2 points. So, of course, Equal Voice is always encouraged to see that there are more women on the ballot. But when we look at the rate of progress across a number of elections, what we also found out is that it would take another 45 years to get equality on the ballot.
You're not willing to wait that long? Is that what I'm hearing in that?
45 years is tough. That's and you know what we've got here is 32% women candidates on the ballot for the major five, but you'll know that in the last House of Commons, we had 25% women MPs elected. So 33% candidates does not necessarily, in fact, we are fairly confident in saying that it's highly doubtful that we'll have a House of Commons that has 30% women MPs.
Can you break it down a bit by party for us? Like, which parties are nominating the most women?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, in the last election in 2011, we saw the NDP with a historic, actually, record of fielding 40% women. And we were pretty thrilled about that. Mm. That was a really high number. This election, they actually beat their own record, and they're at 43% women.
Wow.
That's very high. They are an outlier. The party that is second, believe it or not, is the Greens. So the Greens are fielding 39% women. Of course, that's something to get excited about. However, the reality is in Canada, as many of your listeners will know, is that the Greens, while they're competitive in pockets, overall, we're not expecting, you know, any more than maybe 5, 10 Greens, and, you know, that, those are optimistic projections. So the Greens are at 39, the Liberals are at 31% women candidates, and that's a modest increase from 2011 for that party. The Bloc Québécois, which fields candidates only in Quebec, as you know, is at 28%, and the Conservatives are at 20%, which unfortunately is actually a lower percentage than in 2011.
Interesting. Sometimes I know people will say, well, yeah, there are women running in various ridings, but sometimes they only get a chance in the tough ridings. They're running in places where they can't really win. Do you have any thoughts on that? Does that pattern actually exist?
Well, we did an analysis in 2011 with the support of an academic at Dalhousie University, and we found in 2011 that women were not being fielded in lost cause ridings any more than men. So, yes, there are lots of women in this election on the ballot who don't have a good chance, you know, not because they're not great candidates, but because their parties aren't doing that well in whatever region they're running in. That said, the data that we have suggests that women aren't being, you know, shuffled into those ridings any more than a lot of good men out there who want to run.
Interesting. That's so interesting. Do you think that the... of the notable sort of, I don't know, kind of aspects of this campaign, there is this commitment by Justin Trudeau that a Liberal cabinet would have gender parity, right? Do you think that matters to people when they're, particularly women who are thinking about supporting women candidates? Does that give the Liberals a leg up in any way, or is that filtered through to people who are, you know, considering how they're going to vote?
Yeah, you know, it's a good question. I think after the election, you know, we'll have to see, you know, what happens and who's making that cabinet. You know, we saw that the Conservative Party in the last parliament had only 17% women in their caucus and appointed 30% women to cabinet. I think understanding that Canadians want to see diversity, they want to see diversity, and we see that in terms of the choices that are made around how question period rate is taped and,
right.
and who is shuffled and positioned around various leaders. So I think parties understand intuitively that Canadians want to see reflected back to them regular men and women, and that does include women. I think what the challenge is that when you have fewer women in your caucus, you have less choice
right.
in terms of your cabinet composition. And the parties are highly variable here in terms of the percentage of candidates you're running. With the NDP running 43%, they could have many more choices available to them, right, than the Conservatives who are running 20%. So, you know, it's partly a question of who you actually elect and who you can draw from once, you know, you're either an opposition party in terms of considering critic roles or your government.
Nancy, it's always seemed to me more straightforward to encourage women to support women when it comes to nominating candidates. I'm always slightly confused by what women who are interested in there being more women in politics should do during the election. So if I'm interested in encouraging and promoting and supporting women in politics, but I don't like the party that has nominated a woman in my riding. Should I feel badly about that? Like, what do you encourage people to do? Like, should women default to a woman in one of their riding, or should they ignore that and just vote for the party they like most? Seriously, I know it sounds like a funny question, but
no, it's a great question.
How do you get around
it's
that?
It's a great question. And women and men are up against that every day, right? So obviously, we know that Canadians are choosing largely on party banner, sometimes on individual, right? So parties matter a lot in this election, as they do in every election. And we're not asking Canadians to park a partisan consideration, if that's what matters most to them, and just vote for a woman because there's a woman on the ballot. But there are many ways that you can support a woman, and it's not necessarily that you support a woman on the ballot in your riding if that's not ultimately the choice you want to make. So clearly you can make a donation. You can also tweet and Facebook about candidates that you are really enthusiastic about in this election. And certainly breaking through the noise with so much going on, you know, the attention you might give to a candidate two provinces over, where you may have friends and family or, you know, Facebook followers or whatever, is not insignificant. But, you know, at the end of the day, John, I think what really matters beyond this election is really encouraging women in your network to consider running. Because what we know is, with only 33% women on the ballot in this election, the chances of a historic breakthrough of getting to 30% women in the House may in fact be quite small. And we have to start many years out planning for the next election and really ensuring that women seriously consider the opportunity. And when you have, you know, as we do in this election, 53 ridings with no women on the ballot for the major five parties, and you break that down further, and when you look at just the major three, so the Conservatives, the Liberals, and the Democrats, there are 97 ridings with no women on the ballot.
Is that right?
So that's, you know, that's major. How many with no men on the ballot for the major three parties? Five. So there are lots of places in Canada where you're going to cast a vote, and there is no woman on the ballot.
Yeah.
And we're not saying that you must vote for women. We're not at all. But we do believe Canadians should have better choices.
That was Nancy Peckford of the group Equal Voice speaking with Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief, John Geddes. Still to come, we speak about the issues facing Aboriginals that are not being talked about on the campaign trail. Musician Dan Mangan discusses his decision to join a concert series protesting the Conservatives. And the Maclean's panel discusses the fall in support for the NDP. Welcome back to Maclean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio. Still to come on the show, musician Dan Mangan gets political with an anti-conservative concert series, and we discuss the sliding poll numbers for the NDP in the Maclean's panel. But first, there have been many issues popping up on the campaign trail over the past 2 months, from supply management for dairy farmers to infrastructure and transit. Even the NAQUB has popped up as an issue of focus. But it seems like the problems facing our Aboriginal peoples have not been put in the spotlight. In fact, Scott Gilmore has a story about this on Macleans.ca. He points out there are many significant issues facing our Indigenous communities that are not getting enough attention from our federal politicians. Gilmore writes that if you take a look at the average numbers since the election campaign began, it's safe to estimate that more than 1,400 Aboriginal kids have dropped out of school, 45 Aboriginal children have died in infancy, 182 have committed suicide, more than 1,000 Aboriginal children and more than 6,000 Aboriginal women were sexually assaulted, 33,000 were violently victimized, and 11 were murdered. Maclean senior writer Laura Payton is looking deeper into this issue and speaks with Catherine Hensel, a First Nation lawyer who specializes in Aboriginal law.
What are the most important issues right now that face Aboriginal Canadians?
Well, there's a number of them. One is recovering from the very tragic legacy of residential schools and the 60s scoop and the child welfare incursions into our communities and the needless removal of children, whether it's through residential school or through child welfare. Those initiatives have had, or social experiments, have had a devastating impact on our communities and continue to have that. The other is alienation from land and resources, culture and language. Unfortunately, those effects are still being experienced today. People are still being removed from their land, and still land is still being wrongfully taken without consultation and or compensation, and with the result that our communities are impoverished. And the third and little understood element of it, I think, is that Indigenous people living in, or Aboriginal people living within their communities, on their territory, and within their cultures, actually receive less government resources than you or I do living in Ottawa, or I live in Toronto. So it's very difficult, given economies of scale and the other challenges that I've just spoken to meet basic needs within communities, infrastructurally or with respect to health and education, social services, because those communities actually make do with far less than municipalities and other communities across the country. So those are all very pressing issues, and they have a real concrete impact on people's daily lives.
There was some discussion a couple of weeks ago when AFN Chief, Grand Chief Perry Bellegarde said that he hadn't voted in the last election. There was discussion then about whether or not First Nations people should be voting in a federal election. Do you think that one of the issues is that the federal parties just don't see a lot of votes among Aboriginal Canadians?
Yeah, and demographically, we're depending on how you characterize us, we're 3 or 4% of the population. So in 51 ridings, we are apparently sort of a swing vote or potentially determinative vote. But in the rest of the country, there's not enough Aboriginal people there to actually have a significant impact demographically on the electoral outcome. So it's really up to non-Aboriginal Canadians to vote for the candidates who are going to do the honourable thing with respect to Aboriginal Canadians. It's really important too for Canadians to understand that First Nations, Métis, and Inuit people. For many years, and still today, many of them don't consider themselves Canadian citizens or primarily Canadian citizens. They consider themselves to be primarily and identify primarily with their own nations, cultures, territory, and language. Their leadership is the leadership that they have within their community, and that's selected by them, whether by their custom or through the Indian Act's terms. And until, you know, relatively recently, until the 60s, First Nations people living on reserve weren't permitted to vote. So increasing numbers of Aboriginal people across the country do intend to vote in this election and to engage politically.
And moving to a really emotional issue on missing and murdered Indigenous women, there's been a lot of discussion about, you know, the violence against Indigenous women over the past couple of years. And it's a sensitive issue, I think, too, because when you look at the numbers, a lot of the time it's Indigenous men who are perpetrating the violence.
Right.
How do we tackle a problem like that?
Well, first of all, just to reframe the question a little bit or to comment on the question, it's important to note that Indigenous women or First Nations women, Aboriginal women, are disproportionately preyed upon by non-Aboriginal men as well. So while there has been much made of the fact that, like all other female women who are the victims of violence, it's largely people within our own families and communities that are the perpetrators. Same for non-Aboriginal women. You know, Robert Picton, for example, his victims were primarily Aboriginal women, and many other serial killers across the country have preyed primarily on Aboriginal women and other, you know, other violent men, and they're non-Aboriginal people. Having said that, violence against women is a very live issue in Aboriginal families and communities. Part of the answers to the ways to prevent and to intervene in that violence and to stop the cycle of violence tie back to the same issues that I mentioned at the beginning of the interview. Dealing with, healing from, recovering from in a meaningful way the intergenerational effects of residential schools and the 60s scoop, alienation from land and culture and territory. Insofar as we solve this problem, it's going to be within our culture and within our communities, and by recovering our ability to safely live with each other and amongst Canadians, but as Indigenous people. And so it's not a matter, and I think the current initiatives or the initiatives to date on the part of the Conservative government to deal with violence against Indigenous women as singular crimes, not sociological phenomena, are, I think it's politically cynical. It will not be effective. It'll actually be counterproductive.
That's McLean senior writer Laura Payton speaking with Catherine Hensel, a First Nation lawyer who specializes in Aboriginal law. Coming up after the break, we speak with a popular Canadian musician about a concert series aimed at protesting the Conservatives, and the McLean's panel is here to discuss the changing dynamics in the polls. Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio. Coming up, we'll have the McLean's panel to discuss a shift in support in the election campaign. But before we get to that, we want to take a look at how Canadian musicians are trying to get involved in the federal election. Stealing all my dreams. That is a new song released by the well-known band Blue Rodeo. In a post on their website, the members say they normally don't speak with one voice, but they all feel that the Harper government has taken the country down the wrong path. So they wrote a song about it called Stealing All My Dreams. The song attacks the Conservatives on everything from their environmental and economic record to Aboriginal rights and government scandals.
Warplanes, computer games, robocalls, and Senate shame.
But Blue Rodeo is not the only group speaking out in this campaign. In fact, artists such as Feist, The Sadies, and Dan Mangan have all taken part in a concert series aimed at protesting the Conservatives during this election campaign. The concerts were organized by Stars singer Torquil Campbell. McLean's associate editor Aaron Wary caught up with singer-songwriter Dan Mangan.
Tell me about Imagine October 20th, how it started,
sure.
What it's about.
You know, I mean, as the selection kind of crept up, I was playing a lot of summer shows and festivals and happened upon a bunch of shows with Stars. And Torquil and I really kind of really resonated on a number of issues. And we were kind of thinking about how hopeless the last election was for people who weren't into the Conservative Party. It sort of seemed like there was an inevitable majority going to happen. And then, of course, that's exactly what happened. And I think we were sort of feeling like, man, what can we do, you know, as people, as citizens, as artists or musicians or whatever, to have some kind of impact. And so, you know, we really wanted to put it in a positive light. There's so much mudslinging, attack ads. I think that that's the root of a lot of electoral apathy, is sort of just the nastiness of it all. And unfortunately, the way that our system works, first past the post, that electoral apathy tends to serve the party that is currently in power, the Conservatives. So, you know, we wanted to do something that felt a little bit more full of light and less kind of nasty. You know, I've seen pictures on Facebook of Stephen Harper with devil horns and stuff. And, you know, it's compelling imagery, but it doesn't really help anybody. So, you know, we talked a lot about this stuff. And we had heard about a couple of events being planned in Vancouver and in Toronto and elsewhere from people who are just trying to kind of locally organize shows to try and kind of get the word, basically as an anti-conservative movement. And over one kind of impassioned conversation, Torquil had suggested this idea of Imagine October 20th and what a breath of fresh air it would be to have like a new chapter in Canadian history. You know, we've had 10 years of this government, you know, whether they've done some good or lots of bad, as you might see it. I think that a lot of people in Canada are ready for something different. And so this idea of waking up on the 20th and having new governance and sort of a new chapter, something new to look forward to, seemed really enlightening. And so I just made basically like a blog posting on this little website. We started this hashtag and it's kind of taken by storm. It's amazing because what it is, it's not an organization. It doesn't accept donations. We're not handling any money whatsoever. We're not spending any money. All we're doing is putting forth like a bulletin board for all the various fragmented progressive fronts to sort of hang their hat on. And anybody who's throwing any kind of event in Canada to try and, you know, encourage or invigorate the left to get out and vote can basically just post their event on the page, and it's sort of like a one-stop shop.
I think there's maybe a certain tendency from some people to say, well, you know, what is it? Why is there even a place for musicians to be telling us how to vote or what to think politically? You know, sort of stick to singing songs kind of thing. Like, do you get any sense of that? Have you gotten any of that reaction?
Oh, absolutely. So oh yeah. Like the shut up and sing sentiment is a real thing. I mean, I've literally had people say that to me, and there's been all kinds of like crazy hate mail coming into the Gmail account that we made for the October 20th thing. And I think that's kind of par for the course. You're going to get flack. You know, you stick your neck out for anything, you're going to get some flack, and you can't please everybody. You can't listen to it. It's like, you know, it's like when people write reviews of your work. Like, if you believe the good stuff, then you have to believe the bad stuff. So all you can do is sort of, you know, broadcast what you are and how you feel and believe none of the believe as little of the response as you possibly can.
Do you think musicians have the power to change political outcomes or to be a significant influence?
Well, I think there's a reason why we, you know, adore Joni Mitchell and Bob Dylan and Neil Young and Joan Baez. I mean, these people are iconic in our eyes now, but I'm sure they were totally hated by half the population back when, you know, and many of them stood up for what they believed in, and they wrote songs that captured people's imaginations and minds. I mean, I think it's probably hard to find any one massive sort of social engagement movement in history that wasn't involving music or the arts in some way. I mean, every movement has had a song or a sort of artistic take on it. I mean, even like the removal of apartheid, there were musicians that, you know, wrote songs that were monumental in changing apartheid in South Africa. And the civil rights movement, you know, there was endless amounts of artists. Nina Simone, you know, comes to mind. And I think that they're not the catalyst. They're not the impetus. They react to what's going on. I think creative people react to what's around them, and they regurgitate it in their own mind frame. So if that's what's happening, it's just a part of it. It's a piece of the puzzle. I think it's an important piece of the puzzle, but I'm not going to give myself as an artist any kind of special platform or extra super duper clout. I think it's just that everybody pieces in what they can, and people who write songs can write songs for that.
That's McLean's associate editor Aaron Wary speaking with singer-songwriter Dan Mangan. It's now time for the McLean's panel. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio, and I'm joined by McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes and McLean's senior writer Laura Payton. Thanks very much for joining me, guys.
Great to be here.
All right, let's talk about the polls. Depending on which poll you're sort of looking at, we've seen a shift in dynamic this past week. The NDP have been ahead for most of the campaign, but now we're seeing them slip to third. And depending on which poll you're looking at, either the Conservatives are well ahead or there's a sort of a tight race between the Conservatives and Liberals for that top spot in the polls. John, what happened here? How did the NDP slip from first to third?
A couple of things going on here. The narrowly focused factor is in Quebec, where a lot of their problem has arisen, is the success of the Prime Minister and also the Bloc Québécois in raising the NICAB issue. This question primarily argued around whether or not the NICAB should be allowed in citizenship ceremonies, but I know what you guys think. I think it's really... that's almost just the sort of the entry point, right? It's the broader question of tolerance, diversity, however you want to frame it in this particular fraud issue. So the NDP's had problems with that. And obviously there are NDP MPs who are trying in Quebec to push back a bit, suggest that they're uncomfortable with the NICAB. They just don't like the idea of the government dictating that you can't wear it at a particular ceremony. So they're going to have to come back there. But there may be a broader issue going on here, eh? One problem is that as the NDP's numbers in Quebec come down, their national numbers look weaker, and that may give an opportunity for the Liberals in other provinces, maybe in places where the NECAP isn't a big deal, to encourage a kind of strategic voting shift where people pull back from the NDP, people who want to see the Conservatives lose and shift their vote to the Liberals.
Now, the Liberals haven't seen the same kind of dip as the NDP. Is that because the base in Quebec for the Liberals is more federalist?
I think that's a safe guess. I haven't looked in depth at the polling numbers. I don't know if anyone but the party strategists know that kind of thing. But certainly, I think given the NDP's level of support in Quebec, where the NECAP is quite an issue, I think that it's safe to say that that is why their numbers are weakening nationally.
Now, on the campaign trail, I mean, for the Conservatives, it's always been about Stephen Harper, Stephen Harper, Stephen Harper. But recently, we've seen Stockwell Day, the former leader, come out and do some campaigning with candidates in Vancouver. We've also had Pierre Poilievre come out and do something in Ottawa with all of the Ottawa candidates behind him talking about the civil service. Is this a fine-tuning, do you think, of the campaign strategy here, Laura?
Well, I don't know if it's a fine-tuning. It was almost like a revocation of their whole messaging for the past 4 years on the civil service. We've heard the Conservatives speak so frequently about the waste in the civil service, abuse of sick leave. The Conservatives brought in legislation that allows them to force a collective agreement on the public service unions. It was interesting to see them then come out yesterday, on Thursday, with this letter to the public service from Stephen Harper saying, we respect you, we think that you're the best civil service in Canada, we've been honored to work with you. Mr. Poilievre even went as far as to say that if we're reelected, we will continue to protect you. And I think it's hard for them to be credible on that issue because of the hard line they've taken in the past, which admittedly plays really well outside of Canada.
Outside of Ottawa.
Outside of Ottawa. There's a lot of civil servants in Ottawa. I've been looking at the numbers. There's about 89,000 civil servants in Ottawa, federal civil servants. In Ottawa, there's more on the Gatineau side. And then you look at the municipal and provincial civil servants living in the capital, and that makes it a substantial voting block. We've seen in some of the regional polls done by Lead Now, which is an anti-conservative group, like, let's make no bones about that. But some of the regional polling is showing that a couple of the conservative candidates here are in trouble. They no longer have John Baird, who had a bit of a better reputation than Mr. Poilievre for being able to work across partisan bounds for the good of the city. And, they might be seeing a bit of a backlash given all of those factors.
There are a couple of articles in Maclean's magazine and online focusing on Liberal leader Justin Trudeau. John, why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Paul Wells, our colleague Paul Wells, writing on the Trudeau campaign right now. He was out and covering it, looking at some factors. I would say, the most interesting part of Paul's story is the focus on Trudeau's emphasis on C-24, the Citizenship Act. You remember in the last debate his coming out and saying quite forcefully that he was defending the right of convicted terrorists to maintain their Canadian citizenship. I think in principle that's a courageous stand. As a campaigning tack, you've got to admit it has risks associated with it, right? And the Conservatives pounced on that and they think it's so. Paul picks up on that element in particular of Trudeau's campaign and focuses on it in a way I think is really interesting. I wrote a piece about Trudeau and his relationship with his late father for two reasons. I wrote it because I think people are naturally interested in it. How does he compare and contrast with his dad? But also because it's come up repeatedly on the trail now, both in substantial ways where Trudeau, for example, Justin Trudeau, this is, invokes the Charter of Rights and Freedoms as part of his father's legacy to him, but also in more less substantial ways, like when he goes out on a canoeing photo op on the Bow River and conjures up those memories of his dad canoeing in so many people's eyes. So I think Pierre Trudeau casts a shadow over this campaign, and it's interesting to look at the ways that his son is like him and not like him. There's a lot to be said there, but one of the things is Justin has never claimed to be the intellectual powerhouse his dad was. But people who watch him have pointed out that compared to where his father was in his first national campaign, Justin Trudeau has spent a lot more time figuring out how the party works, what the membership thinks. His father was a little more insular and aloof. Justin's been out there and probably knows campaigning, knows the Liberal Party better than his dad did until 4 or 5 years into his run as prime minister. So there's a difference there. Maybe a better grounded campaigner, but not as substantial a thinker. That's one way to see the comparison.
Interesting. And our viewers and listeners should check that out on Macleans.ca and in the
do magazine.
Yeah. All right. Thanks very much, John.
Thanks, Cormac.
Macleans Auto Bureau Chief John Geddes, Macleans Senior Writer Laura Payton, and I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio. Well, that's it for this week's episode. For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.